Game on 2FM.
With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
It's Monday the 16th of August and you've been entertained all afternoon by Jenny Green, but you're now listening to Game On with me, Ruby Walsh, and of course, Marie Crow.
So you are listening to Game On, and as the dust settles on Mayo's win over Dublin, Keith Higgins and Pillar Caffrey are with us to dissect what was a very dramatic affair.
It was dramatic, and also there was a bit of fallout, so former referee Rory Hickey will join us to discuss if the GAA need to move with the times and find some way of helping the person in the middle keep a lid on things.
The Premier League is back with the bang. Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly will join us in studio to review the action.
And of course, Liam Sheedy has announced his retirement as Tipperary manager, so Shane McGrath will hop on the phone to reflect on a wonderful career.
Game on 2FM.
And if you want to get in touch, please do so. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Ruby Walsh, you are very welcome back. You had a nice break, I assume?
I did, Marie. A nice Irish holiday. Wetsuits and wind and rain. But it was lovely, yeah. I did enjoy it. The south coast of Ireland.
It sounds like the 80s minus the wetsuit.
Yeah, basically. If only they had wetsuits when I was a kid, summer holidays would have been so much more enjoyable. But actually, I do believe since I retired and put on about a stone, I find the seawater a good bit easier to cope with.
All right, so you're a little bit...
plump.
That's it. Okay, right. Well, you picked a perfect weekend to come back after because there was so much happening, and the place that we have to start is the Gaelic football, because we had an epic, maybe not full game, but definitely an epic finish to the Mayo and Dublin All-Ireland semi-final. And I'm delighted to say that former Mayo player Keith Higgins and former Dublin manager Pillar Caffrey are both with us to look back on the action. Keith, I'm going to go to you first. It must be a pretty nice place to be now, knowing that after 9 championships attempts in 9 years, that Mayo did get the better of Dublin.
Yeah, it's a nice feeling to be waking up this morning. You know, it was like you couldn't see that result coming at half time on Saturday evening, but it was a long time in the waiting. So I'm more a bit jealous of the lads on Saturday evening, I won't lie, but I think it was well overdue. And I suppose, look, going on what happened from half time onwards, it was well deserved, I think.
Yeah, it really was. And I think one thing that really stuck out when the final whistle blew and we heard Pádraig Ó'Hara's interview, it was just amazing to have the crowds there, because I think if Mayo had done that and the crowds hadn't been there, it would have almost been unjust.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, to go on top of that, it was the crowds and the atmosphere probably helps that Mayo team, you know, especially the way they play or the way they like to play. And I suppose once they kind of got that bit of momentum in the second half and they got a couple of scores and the crowd started to sniff that the comeback was on, I think that probably gave them that extra bit of a lift. So, look, it was great there. And in fairness, for a crowd of 24,000, there was a great atmosphere at it.
Yeah, I could even sense that. My kids are jumping on the couch, roaring Mayo on from when they were 12-8 behind. But surely, Keith, in Croke Park, when a crowd get behind you like that, it makes players run faster.
Yeah, it does. And I suppose, look, a lot of the time you'll probably be listening to maybe psychologists or coaches and people telling you to try and, you know, not get carried away with the crowd and get carried away with the emotion. But sometimes I think when you're in a situation like Mayo are in, you just need that bit of emotion. You just need that bit of, just throwing caution to the wind and just going after it. And definitely, I think, like, it was a funny second half even. Like, I mean, there were still, was it 5 points down with about 10 or 15 minutes to go, like, or you're 62 minutes gone, I suppose, with injury time as well, you know. So, like, even at that stage, you're kind of wondering, can it happen? But the more they kind of just tagged on the scores there and the turnovers, like I said, the crowd just seems to get louder every time. And, you know, it definitely helps. It definitely kind of gets the emotion going, like I said. And, you know, it was definitely what Mayo needed, I think, on Saturday night.
Well, for long enough, it didn't go the way of Mayo, but it did on Saturday. Pillar Caffrey is with us. Pillar, I suppose a couple of days nearly have passed now at this stage. How are Dublin going to reflect on that game?
Yeah, look, firstly, you'd have to say congratulations to Mayo. A well-deserved victory in the end, and particularly in the extra time. They were fantastic. I called it a bonkers game afterwards, because it was so hard to make neither team played actually well at the same time. Dublin started in their better than having any previous championship games this year, but the style of football they're playing this year is quite different. They're holding on to the ball for a lot longer. A couple of years ago, that sort of came into fashion when you were trying to hold on to a lead at the end of a game. But Dublin seem to be doing it from an early stage this year in a lot of games. Not very attractive on the eye, but still, it was quite effective in the first half, and they built up, you know, a very comfortable lead. I thought, you know, the final score before half time probably gave Mayo a bit of a lift going back into the dressing room. But you expected Dublin's third quarter. I think I heard somebody saying for the last 20 championship games, they've won that third quarter. It's really been their championship quarter, and they came out and started like a train again, and great goal chance for James McCarthy, and he just coughed up a few little chances, and all of a sudden, I'd agree with Keith, I thought the crowd were fantastic on Saturday night inside the Mayo crowd. You know, they're great supporters, you'd have to say, with all the heartbreak they've had in Croke Park over the years. They just keep on getting behind that team, and it didn't feel like a 24,000 crowd. And Mayo just, they got oxygen from Dublin not putting them away. And even though it's 60 minutes, Dublin were still 5 points up, you didn't feel that this game was over, because, look, the accolades that Dublin probably have this year has been that, look, their bench, which took them home in so many big games over the years, where they could bring on the likes of Howard and Mannion last year, or Dermot Connolly and McMenamin the year before. You know, they didn't have that luxury this year. The bench is well weakened, and you just felt with Owen Murchin, one of their pacey players, having to go off, and Johnny Cooper. You know, the team is well weakened as we got down to the final stretch, and Mayo deservedly ran out easy enough winners in the end.
Well, I remember when Jim Gavin was appointed Dublin manager, he made a presentation to the media, and it focused on the style of football that he wanted to play, and it was very much an attacking, open brand of football, and we did see that from Dublin for quite a number of years. You mentioned now that it's much more, I guess, it's kind of keep ball nearly at this stage. When did you see that change coming into Dublin football? Was it towards the end of Jim Gavin, or was it when Desi Farrell took over?
No, I think that there's no doubt Dublin were quite capable of doing it under Jim. And then, you know, that Jim's last All-Ireland, they held onto the ball for about 3 minutes near the end of the game. And needs must, but for some reason this year it just became... I think with teams not contesting the kick-out, it just meant that Dublin had every kick-out and teams were flooding men behind the ball. And I was quite surprised by Mayo that they didn't have a go at Dublin in the first half on Saturday. They sort of resorted into a zonal defence and had a +1 defender back there. And it just made it very simple for Dublin to hold on to the ball and hold on to the ball and pick their shots. And, you know, they were quite efficient, and it looked like a challenge game for a long part of the first half. It was quite surreal in there, because Mayo people were disappointed that Mayo weren't having the cut. And Dublin, you know, clocked up 10 points, and you said, right, another 10 points in the second half and this is game over. But in fairness to Mayo, you know, what it was there, they just smelt that Dublin didn't have the legs that they had previously, and obviously when they've seen the bench being emptied and maybe guys as effective as previous years, they just and buoyed on by some fantastic scores, you'd have to say. It was great individual scores taken, and look, inspirational moments like Dermot O'Connor chasing a lost cause and getting his boots with it. It goes back to Kevin McLaughlin, scores a fantastic point. Like, they're moments that are like once in a lifetime moments for a player or a point, and the rise that gave Mayo, they just grew in confidence. And the forward line wasn't playing well all along, but all of a sudden they got a little bit of swagger back into the inside guys, and they started taking better options and better shots.
Keith, watching the game, to me, and I suppose pace, tactics, stamina, all that sort of tough stuff fascinates me. But to watch the second half, Mayo looked so much fresher than Dublin. Did playing all that keep ball just sap the energy out of Dublin?
I suppose something that Dublin will have to reflect on, but you're right, Ruby. Looking in, like, people ask me up in the lower Cusick stand, how could I see it panning out? And really, my eyes were telling me for that last 5 minutes there was only one team going to win this extra time, and that was Mayo, if they believed in themselves and they ran hard at Dublin. I thought Dublin's main players, who had actually been playing well, were getting tied up. You know, John Small had handled a lot of ball. Brian Howard had ran himself into the ground. Davey Bourne had handled an awful lot of ball. And they were just tired. You could see them visibly tiring. Conor Callan had a quiet game, well marshalled. And when Kieran Kilkenny start making turnovers, you felt, right, we're in trouble here now. This is not the Dublin that we've been watching for the last couple of years.
And all you need is a half a yard. I mean, to watch the Mayo players, Tommy Conroy, Ryan O'Donoghue, those lads, from they could see it. Even Tommy Conroy going at Philly McMahon, they knew they had the speed, Keith, and they went at them.
Yeah,
exactly. And it was just, they brought a huge energy to it. Like, and I suppose, Philly said there, like, that was kind of the frustrating part of the first half. They were just standing off Dublin and let Dublin into their comfort zone and do what they do and keep possession. But again, it was very noticeable in the second half. They literally just kind of went man on man, and Dublin didn't have that easy out ball then. You know, like, they were under pressure given the pass, and there was some very kind of, was un-Dublin like turnovers. And you know, like, once the boys kind of has got that bit of momentum, I think Lee was phenomenal driving up from the back all the time. I think Dermot, he went to wing back at one stage when Brian Walsh came on, you know. So you, these guys kind of looking to drive forward. Matty, who had a very, I suppose, quiet first half by his standards as well. And again, I suppose overall, I think he did a good job on fencing. So, yeah, like the likes of Tommy and these boys, and especially Ryan, again, some of the tackles he was putting in up front, they were oozing energy in that last 20 minutes. Again, once he kind of got that momentum behind them, you know, they were just ready to have a go at them. So sometimes it can be very difficult to explain once there's a swing momentum, once you get that bit of energy to you. But, you know, I said, you mentioned that one there with O'Brien, where he just took on Philly and just kind of, he saw his back turn, took a step. And look, that's the thing with these guys, is they do have loads of pace. And I suppose that's the way James Horne wants to play, is he wants to play with a team that is full of pace. So, yeah, look, it paid off there in the second half, and particularly in extra time.
One word that we're hearing quite a lot is un-Dublin-like. And Pillar, one of the things that was definitely un-Dublin-like was the season, the disruption to the season. And I think if you go back maybe as far as the fallout from the COVID situation, then you throw in Stephen Cluxton, a lot of big players walking away unexpectedly. I suppose on reflection, there probably should have been more concern than there was, that maybe not everything was all right in the camp.
Yeah, look, I think there's no doubt, Marie, that looking back on things, when you take it, you know, a Dublin camp that have held themselves to very high levels of accountability and carried themselves really well through their match-winning run of games and All-Ireland titles. And, you know, I think the COVID breach, I would think, probably did a lot to unsettle the camp. I'd say, like, even, for example, you know, there's a couple of teachers in the squad, frontline workers like Mick Fitzsimons, the doctor, you know, so a lot of people would have families that are on frontline service. So I think it probably rattled the squad more than we actually thought. Obviously, the Stephen Cluxton issue was never resolved all year. And, you know, the Paul Mannion not coming back to play this year was a huge loss. Eric Lowndes walking away from the squad 4 weeks ago. They're all things that really didn't add up. You know, Desi put on a strong front and said it was all manageable within. But you know yourself, when little things like this are raising their head, things aren't right within the squad. And look, they were still very close to getting over the line in normal time yesterday. You know, the last two scores that they gave away were absolutely crazy. But you'd have to say, like, once extra time came, that, look, Mayo just, they were doing on a different level.
Pillar, when you look at it, when John Small did hit on McLaughlin, Colin Bascal really should have scored a goal. That was game over then. That's how close this game actually was to being won by
Dublin. And look, and any football fan up and down the country would like to send their best wishes to Owen McLaughlin, a terrible injury to get at this stage of the season, ruling them out of a chance of playing an All-Ireland final. But look, this Mayo team, they're going to be around for a while. I think they'll be contesting a couple of All-Irelands in the next few years. And it looked, that was a huge moment in the game. If Colin Bascal scores that goal, there's 7 points in it. You know that Mayo, like, they bring greatest athleticism to their game, but I don't know whether they would have the wherewithal to get back. But look, who knows? You know, the run had to come to an end at some stage. Dublin have been a fantastic watch. They've broken all sorts of records. But there will be a fallout from this, in terms of, that'll be a hard dressing room to walk back into. next January or whenever they resume, fellas will get it hard to look each other in the face because, when it finished, it didn't finish. They would have wanted with their boots on and their shields held high. Like they were a bet team from once Mayo got back level. I thought they were spent docket and they looked fatigued and ragball by the end. And then the next thing that kicks in is look, a bit of discipline goes out the window. Fellas just get frustrated and it's a sloppy finish to it from a Dublin perspective. But look, there's no grudges in Dublin. Everyone will say that the better team has gone forward and helped the All Ireland. We'd wish Mayo that he finally go and do it.
Keith, as Pillar says, the run has come to an end for Dublin. But as a former player, what has that Dublin team done for GAA? What standards has it raised? How much has it brought the game on the level they were at? Has it made you all chase them?
Yeah, I suppose teams have had no other choice but to try and chase them. I think if you were to look particularly at ourselves here in Mayo, probably Kerry as well. And I'm sure it's probably like Tyrone, Donegal, all these guys are probably looking at Dublin and they've been the standard bearers, I think. You know, here in Mayo, obviously, there's been a lot of change in personnel over the last 2 years. Staying down in Kerry, they seem to be building a team that was ready to eventually take on Dublin. You know, it was a very athletic team, you know, some really good forwards. So, yeah, look, they've raised standards a lot. Some teams have probably tried to get up to that standard and some teams probably haven't, you know, and I suppose that's... There's been so much debate about the standard of football in Leinster over the last 10 years. So, look, there's no doubt that they're going to go down as the greatest football team in history. You look at some of the football they played during that six in a row and even in the Cup of Ireland before that was as good as we've seen. In fairness to Jim Gavin, when he came in first, about the style of play he wanted to play and it was an all-out attack and play and they refined it then after the loss to Donegal in 14. So, look, they deservedly go down as one of the greatest football team ever and with some of the greatest footballers ever, those guys there with what, 6, 7, 8 All-Ireland medals. It's some achievement. And I suppose, just going back to the previous point there, as Peter was saying, like any time you have a dressing room that loses the likes of Stephen Cluxton, Keane O'Sullivan, Bernard Brogan, McMenamin, Mannion, McCaffrey, these guys, like they're once-in-a-generation players. It's very, very hard to replace them. They're impossible to replace them with the same quality. So, look, they've been the standard bearers. They've been the greatest team ever. And I suppose it was always going to come to an end at some stage. We saw with Kilkenny there back in the 10 or so years ago with the hurling when they were going really strong and like Sheffield and Tommy Welch and these boys retired. You know, sometimes they're irreplaceable. So, look, you have to give them as much credit and as much plaudits as you can because they were so good for so long.
And Pillar, you do know a lot of those players that are coming through, a lot of the ones that Desi Farrell will be transitioning. I know it's probably a difficult time for Desi right now because, as you know, when you're the Dublin manager, you do get a lot of attention, a lot of focus. When we do go back into the next championship season, do you think we're going to have a new look Dublin team?
Yeah, look, I'd be surprised if some of the senior fellas didn't call it a halt. And, you know, I think Desi will stay on. And you know he knows what's out there. Some of these guys, it was the first taste of championship football at this level, and I'm sure they'll improve. You know, Leinster is still very achievable next year, which we don't know what format it's going to be in these times. But Dublin aren't going away; they'll be there or thereabouts. But you would just think that look, that there is a certain finality to what happened in Croke Park on Saturday night in terms of that group, and I know the team that finished the game out was a long way away from the swashbuckling team of 2017 and 2018, but you know, there's still great pride. But look, there is a change coming because even if you look at our minors this year, well bet by Meath, our 20s well bet by Offaly, the talent or the conveyor of talent that came through. Like you take off the 121 team a couple of years ago, we got Conor Callaghan, Brian Howard and Owen Merchant. Now that's some haul from three fellas who, you know, have had a brilliant couple of years with Dublin. That's some haul from one team where last year's team, they got to a 20 All-Ireland final were bet by Galway. We have one player through from that team. So that's the type of once-in-a-lifetime generation of player you were getting that was ready-made to step in and make a contribution at the highest level. So it might be a bit of a barren spell for Dublin coming, but look, we remain hopeful.
No need to split the county just yet then.
Set them up.
That's it, Pillar. I think we'll be a few more years before we'll make any judgment on what the future of Dublin football looks like. Pillar Caffrey and Keith Higgins, thank you so much for joining us. Now we are joined on the line by former national panel referee Rory Hickey. Rory, look, I think a lot of the focus was on things that happened during the game that Conor Lane didn't manage to pick up. But I think overall, when you look at, or just overall, really, when you look at his performance, what was your assessment of it?
Yeah, I thought he did well, bar the one obvious call, you know. And God, I really felt for him. It's split second stuff. If he had had a chance, you know, there's been a lot of talk about TMOs and about use of fourth officials and stuff. If he'd had a chance to have a look at that one more time, what nearly looked like a perfect shoulder, as we know now, ended up with a double jawbreak for the poor Mayo player, and he'll miss the All-Ireland. But Conor De Welly's strong referee, he's three All-Irelands under his belt. He's an experienced guy. But, you know, that was a tough game. That was a tough game to referee. I was sitting down watching it and thinking, I'm kind of glad I'm retired now, to be honest.
Rory, we all watch every other sport, and we see VAR and soccer, TMO and rugby, and they've probably, some will say, hindered the games. But when you're watching John Small alone with Loughlin incident yesterday, just for foul play, if the fourth official is into Conor Lane's ear, that you need to look at that again. And someone on the sideline calls it. And there's no deliberation. It's just someone in the stands. Snappy, quick decisions. A GAA pitch is so big and things happen so fast. You're a former referee. Surely they need more help than they're getting.
They definitely do. During my time now, when I was knocking around, Hawkeye came into being, and I was there for the first day using Hawkeye, and I said, technology is really advancing here. They're really going to help us out. And now Hawkeye is seamless. It's accepted at every game. There's no debate about scores. And once I retired, coming up 3 years now, I thought during that time that they'd move towards a TMO. Now, there's couple of schools of thought as well. Some of my former colleagues, even speaking to them today, reckon that there's no need for a TMO to activate or reinvigorate what the fourth official does. Okay, at the moment, the fourth official looks after the time and looks after the substitutes. Get him on his feet, like they have in Australian rules, have guys around the bench or around the side, you know, get him on his feet, get him up and down the sideline, and get him helping the referee more. Okay, for me, with the amount of cameras and with the technology that's there, I really, really think that they should go towards some sort of a TMO, some sort of a television match official that, take yesterday's example, it's a great example. Conor could have said, hang on here a minute, lads, have we missed something there? Can we have a look at that? And, you know, you have kind of sounds like a job interview here now, Ruby, like, but I'm not really looking for a job. But, you know,
you'd be good, Eric. Go on, we're listening.
You'd have a retired referee sitting up there in the Hawkeye kind of booth with every angle available to him, and he could just stop the play and say, yeah, okay, Conor, looked like a good shoulder, but he's actually caught this guy in the head, giving the appropriate action. Now, I'd really thought it'd be in the game by now, like, and we're not talking about National League, though, first round of the National League, having TMOs move around the country, but for the latter end of the Championship, from maybe provincial finals on, right up to All-Ireland finals, I mean, this would really, really help the referees. They have enough to do. There's one guy in the middle of the field trying to watch 30 guys, and they went at it hot and heavy there over the weekend, Mayo and Dublin. You know, he's enough to do. He just needs a small bit more help. I think the technology is there. The people are there. I think that the guys at the top need to really have a look at this. If you cast your mind back, you remember David Goff had a similar incident there in a Kerry match. And, you know, if he had a TMO that day, we wouldn't be having this conversation now. But I think it's time for it now.
There is a huge amount of focus, Rory, though, on the O'McLaughlin, John Small incident. And a lot of people are, I suppose, just really, really upset that something like that could happen in a football match and that the game wasn't stopped. I know it's only one man in the middle of the field doing his best, but just on reflection, which is, you know, an easy thing to do, do you think that Conor Lane, or what do you think that Conor Lane should have done differently?
Well, first of all, Marie, you have to realise that he thought it was a fair shoulder, right? Which, to be honest, when I saw it on the TV first, I said, wow, that's a great hit. But then, you know, he's chasing the ball up the field. He has to follow the play. But obviously, Like, the player is hurt, and we know now that the player has a broken jaw. So the medical people ran into him. Conor Lane wasn't aware of that. You know, he was gone up the field and following the play up the field. He thought it was a fair shoulder. So, I mean, to criticise, and I've read a lot of it and seen a lot of it, criticise the referee for not stopping the game. He did stop the game at the next opportunity he got. You know, if he thought it was a foul, he'd have stopped straight away and taken the action. But he didn't. And the play went on. The referee thought it was a fair shoulder, which I, on first thoughts, I thought it was a fair shoulder as well. But then, obviously, like, we've all seen, you know, we've all seen the images, seen it slow down. But he didn't get that. He got the split-second decision. He had to make that decision and move on. He made it. The game moved on. But the medical people, in fairness, they were out to him quick enough. So I don't take that criticism that Conor Lane is getting that he didn't stop the game. He did. He came back to the player at the next opportunity he got.
There were a few other incidents as well that were very clear that he missed. But one thing that really seems to frustrate people is the fact that when there is a foul, it's really difficult to predict what it's going to be, whether it's going to be a black card, whether it's going to be a yellow card. And one that definitely irked people was Davy Byrne and his yellow card when a lot of people thought it should have been a black.
Yeah, was this for the pull back rather than the pull down?
That was that one.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, the rules states, you know, not to be quoting rules or anything, but the rules states that the player has to be pulled down. Now, the player was pulled back, and we've seen in the championship this year, and we've seen years gone by, this sort of a kind of a bear hug, you know, to just hold up the player, stop the momentum going up the field. And if the player stays on his feet, it's a yellow card, it's rough play, but it's not a black card. So it was a pull back, a pull of the jersey back, rather than a pull down. If the player went to the floor, then you're moving into black card territory. Now, it does tick a couple of the boxes, and I think this is what frustrates people. It does tick the box that it was cynical, you know, but it doesn't tick the other box that it was a pull down. It was a pull back rather than a pull down, and that's where that needs to be tidied up, that whole situation. I think like, if the referee deems it to be cynical, he stopped this guy breaking away, that should be enough. Give him the black card, put him into, but they're, at the moment their hands are tied, the refs, the rules don't state that.
So if you put this TMO in the stand, you're having your way, Rory.
Ruby just wants a TMO, okay?
It doesn't. I'm not for slowing down the play. I think in rugby it's gone way too far. I mean, referees should still have power to make decisions. But, like, what about John Small and Ryan O'Donoghue? What about the swing Paddy Small made? What about James McCarthy and Dermot O'Connor?
That's right,
would you look into everything, or would we just have
that, that's the thing, Ruby, right? Like, we can't be looking at everything, okay? So let's say that the TMO is in, okay? Everyone's aware of it. So the players or the captain gets three times during the game that he can say, ref, we want another look at that. And I think that will stop the slowing down the game altogether. So they get three goals each, we'll call it, to go to the TMO, unless the referee has already, you know, gone to the TMO, decided I need to have another look, I need someone to have another look at this. And I think, as you said, quick decision make, get on with the game, it'll add to the game. There's too much at stake nowadays. Gaelic football and hurling has gone to massive, massive levels. Heads are putting their whole lives on the line. There's one man in the middle of the field, and any bit of technology, any bit of help that man in the middle of the field can get should be looked at by the GAA by now.
And is that the view of referees? Like, you were on the panel for a long time. Would the majority of referees, would all the referees like things to progress in that direction?
Yeah, anything that'll help, Marie. I'd say, you know, look, I'm a retired ref. I don't mind doing a few interviews, but the lads that are refing now, you know, they have to deal with what's there. But, nearly 100% sure that if a TMO was in operation, it'd help out everyone. It should take an awful lot of pressure off the refs. And why not? Why not? Why not go at it? There's a cohort of guys there now that are retired around the place. Instead of sending them to the referee to advise him, you know, they changed this assessor name to advise. Conor Lane didn't need an assessor's report or an advisor's report yesterday, but he may have needed a TMO.
Exactly. Rory Hickey, thanks a million for taking our call. We're going to take a quick break.
2FM.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Naturally good food packed with protein.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So the Premier League returned last weekend as well, where we had 10 games, 10 winners, 34 goals. And guess what, Alan Colley?
Tell me.
Man United are on top.
But the question is, Ruby, how long will they stay there?
That's the question I have for you. You're the expert. I'm only a fan.
Well, they might stay there for another few weeks and they might be up near the top, obviously, throughout the whole season. But I suppose the bigger question is, will they win it? And I obviously didn't think they would before the start of the season. We're only a game in. They were very impressive. But I'd be a bit disappointed with Leeds as well. Obviously, United deserve huge credit, Ruby, and that's fine. And they played really, really well. Bruno picking up where he left off, absolutely amazing. To be fair, Pogba as well, who I'd be highly critical of times, was brilliant. But Leeds, they played Leeds last year and they lost 6-2 and it was kamikaze stuff. Leeds lost 6-2. How Bielsa didn't learn from that, I don't know. And I suppose we mentioned that here in the preview the other night, that it's boom or bust with them, and it was certainly bust at the weekend. But from a Man United perspective, and you look at all the other teams who are obviously going to be challenging, they certainly put out a statement, and it'll be interesting to see, can they maintain it?
Yeah, I think Alan, it was excellent performance. Sorry, Ruby, you're probably buzzing after the weekend.
I was just about to say, like, come on, they got Southampton next, then Wolves, they've got to be a top for a while. Like,
I think that running could really help them, I think, because, you know, before as well, you see Varane coming out on the pitch and there was a sense of a superstar arriving at the club, like the build up to it, the atmosphere around the place, the fans were going crazy, and then the performance they put in. And I think Leeds did play to the strengths of Manchester United, because United are so good in the counter-attack and breaking teams down, and you know, Leeds were just wide open. But with the run of games they have, it looks like it's going to be a good one for them.
I know, Alan, that you are still very reserved about Paul Pogba, but when you see what he can do, how does Solskjaer get the best out of him? Like, is he going to be able to do that? Because when you look at what Pogba is capable of, you can't but think, when you have a player like that in your team, that you can play like they did against Leeds all the time.
Well, it's his job to get the best out of him, Marie. And up to now, I suppose, if you're asking the question, can he should have by now. And he hasn't. That's the thing. And the criticism of him, and we're obviously comparing him to the best managers around, with Guardiola and Klopp and Tuchel, as we says the other night, they'd get the best out of him. Deschamps gets the best out of him with France. And you look at him in the Euros, he was absolutely brilliant. I think a lot of it comes down to Pogba as well, because you look at his performance at the weekend and he was absolutely brilliant. But he needs to realise that he needs to be doing that week in, week out. And I think Solskjaer indulges him at times, Marie, and you're not going to get the best out of anyone week in, week out if you are indulging him. Hopefully he's built up a little bit of a rapport, obviously, with Bruno Fernandes, a player that's on the same page as him in terms of quality as well. I'm sure he's delighted with the likes of a Varane and Sancho coming in. The likes of that will motivate him even more if he needs any more motivation. Almost kind of turn him on for the games, Marie. So the question is, will Solskjaer get the best out of him? Up to now, I don't think he has, and it's no good getting it in one or two games. If you're going to win a league with Man United, to overtake the likes of what they're competing against and the quality that the other teams have, he needs to be doing it week in, week out.
Stephen, technically, what about the pass from Pogba to Mason Greenwood?
Yeah, honestly, technically, some of the stuff he does on the pitch, and you watch it, his execution of passes and his range of passes is just frightening. It really is. He is an all-round complete midfield player, apart from mentally he switches off too much. But that's the issue.
Well, then he's not all-round.
Technically he's all-round. Yeah, that's the most important bit, and that's the problem, because you see these glimpses of him and you can just wax lyrically about him. Like some of the passes in the Euros as well, and you're thinking, jeez, this guy is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden he switches off, loses a runner, misses a header from a corner, and they're down, and you're kind of thinking that's the issue. And I think you're right about Solskjaer, because Mourinho was too hard on him and pushed him the other way. He was like, he just didn't take it and was taught hard, you know, I treat him tough and get him to work probably. That didn't work. Solskjaer's the other way, just kick gloves, and is not, no way he puts pressure on him to perform at a high level all the time. And I think that's what he needs. He needs an in between to be
like
able
a Klopp.
To, yeah, like a Klopp, exactly.
Or I need someone to book him a hair appointment every Friday afternoon so he can get whichever colour he wants for the weekend. That might put him in good form.
Alan, on Friday I said that there's no way that Manchester City are going to do what they did last year and start really badly. And I was completely wrong. They came out and just did not turn up at all against Spurs, but full credit to Spurs, who look like they might be able to do something this season.
I think, to be fair, they probably deserve more credit out of the fact that Man City were poor, Marie, because the manager got it spot on. And if you look at, I suppose, the way they played, in terms of that they were happy to sit in low blocks with the back four and obviously what was sitting in front of them, but they had such a threat on the counter-attack with Bergwijn, Son and Moura, and obviously the pace of those caused all sorts of problems for Man City. And that's Man City's Achilles heel, really, when they come up against teams like that. I remember Leicester playing at the Etihad last year, and obviously the pace of Vardy as well, and it caused them all sorts of problems. That if you're able to sit back and you have a good shape about you, that you can contain Man City in what they throw at you, if you have that outball from the counter-attack then, and you have players obviously with the quality of Son and Bergwijn, you can cause Man City all sorts of problems. And that's what we saw at the weekend. To be fair to Nuno Santo, he got it spot on. He was absolutely brilliant. Of course, the big hullabaloo was about Kane before the match and obviously after the match. I think it's even more likely that he's going to go to City now, Murray.
One thing as well, Stephen, I know that you know Daniel Levy well enough, I suppose, at this stage. But
is he in the phone book?
He's definitely in the phone book. But when you're Manchester City and you see that performance against Spurs, are the Manchester City owners now going to be like, well, we need Harry Kane more than ever? Are they going to be ringing Daniel and saying, like, look, here's the 150 plus million that you want now? And he's just sitting back on, I told you, if you gave me exactly what I wanted, I would give you Harry Kane.
Oh, he is. He's completely in the driver's seat. He knows that after that, Tottenham couldn't have done any more to make his position stronger. And we were joking about it before, saying it's almost like Pep sent him out to perform that way so the deal would get pushed through to get Kane. The City couldn't have performed any different to what they were to make Kane look like he was any more vital for that team, because they were toothless. They didn't have a centre focal point for attack. They were so good on the eye going forward in spaces, and Grealish looked wonderful at times, but there was no end product and no finishing of an end product. And Kane, that's what he gives you. So the game played out for, it's going to be a 150 million deal and it's going to get done. That's, you feel like it's going to happen now.
Alan, Stephen mentioned a £100 million man there, Jack Grealish. I was listening to Graeme Souness, who wasn't overly complimentary about his performance on Saturday.
No, he wasn't. I think he'd done okay, Ruby, but as you say, for £100 million, it doesn't matter whether it's your first game or your 27th game, you need to be performing. And obviously, if we're critical of Pogba of not doing it consistently, I suppose we have to judge Grealish on the same level, and he has to be doing it week in, week out. I thought he'd done okay. It was interesting more so, I suppose, the position that he played him in, Ruby, because we spoke about it Friday night that at Villa he's almost given that license and free role to roam because he was the star player and he could almost do what he wanted. And I think he's going to have to be a little bit more disciplined in this Man City team. And if you look at the position he took up, left side of a three in that midfield, he never really crossed over to the other side, or he never went wandering looking for the ball the way he would at Villa, almost feeling like the big star player in the playground that's always getting the ball. He was like that at Villa. He won't be like that at Man City, but they have so much quality all over the pitch. I think once he beds in, he'll be fine, and he will. It might take him a couple of games to get up to speed, and obviously he's getting used to the players around him, but I still think he'll be fine.
And you could see as well that a couple of the senior players were kind of telling him what to do as well, so it's going to take him a little bit of time to get into Pep's system, because Pep does have his system. Just speaking of players coming back, Virgil van Dijk is back for Liverpool. He looked very comfortable at the weekend, I have to
say, Stephen.
Took
you 4 minutes to get to Liverpool.
Yeah, he
now
did.
Now we're here.
He did. And listen, he's not going to come back the way he was initially, because the injury he had was a really bad injury, and it takes a time to get back up to that level. Playing Premier League friendlies and reserve games and pre-season is one thing. Actual games from the Premier League and the pace they're played at, but he did look comfortable. But you can just see the aura he has and the rest of the team around him, how it affects them. Having him on the pitch makes everybody else's game raise, because you think, we've got him behind us. And that's what type of player he is. He is, I know Henderson's the captain, but he is that real captain on that side. He's the one that when he's on the pitch gives everybody a boost. And that was what was, it was evident.
Yeah, I said before, obviously on Friday, Emery, I know I've gone for Chelsea and I think it'll be between them and Man City, but I would also have Liverpool in the mix. And the reason being is, when you have the full complement of players, they're still every bit as good as the rest of them, whether if the squad to back up if they get a couple of injuries. But if you have the likes of Van Dijk and Gomez to come back and Trent, these players are unbelievable players. And obviously the main thing with Liverpool as well on top of that is, if you get the front three firing and you look at them at the weekend, Mane, Firmino coming on scoring, it's a great start for him because he was poor last year. Salah getting his obligatory opening day season goal as well. So yeah,
didn't
Liverpool
pick him for fantasy though.
Who didn't?
Me.
Did you not?
No.
No. I don't play that fantasy football. And the reason I don't, Marie, is because it is fantasy football. You want the real deal. Looking at them at the weekend, I have to say Liverpool were very good. I know it's only Norwich, but it was a good win for them and a good start. And I think there was three or four teams that were impressive. To be fair, obviously Chelsea as well. So it's been a really good start. I think I enjoyed the weekend and I think we're in for a really competitive season.
I can't believe you didn't mention Brentford. They beat Arsenal 2-0, like. You gave him no mention, Alan Colley.
But Ruby, beating Arsenal is like beating, I'm not sure, our junior team. Arsenal are so poor and so bad. We mentioned it here on Friday night about,
still Arsenal and they're still Brentford. They're only at the game promoted. Like, come on, give them some bit of.
I'll give, yeah, but I would give Brentford the credit more so, but I think Arsenal, to be fair, and this has been Arsenal for the last 5, 6, 7 years, obviously once Wenger went, they just haven't sorted out the problems that have always been there, and that's the defensive issues. They're so weak. You look at the long throw, no one dealing with the issue. The manager even said it after the match, Frank, the Brentford manager, that we knew we would bully them almost physically, and that's the perception, and that's the view of every manager going up against them. They signed Ben White for 50 million and he was poor, to be fair, the other night, and it'll be a major worry going forward because Ivan Toney absolutely destroyed him, particularly in the aerial battles as well. So there's no dominant force at the back, no dominant figure, and Arteta's fighting for his job already, because you mentioned, Ruby, about the good run of games that United have to start off. Arsenal have a nightmare because they've Chelsea and Man City in their next two games.
They really do. And, you know, we're talking about teams that are going to challenge. Alan Cawley has tipped Chelsea to do that. Look, they've turned up again. They turned up in the Super Cup. They turned up again this weekend and still have Lukaku to go in.
Yeah, Lukaku and Kante, who we were talking about, who didn't feature either, which is just crazy. You just look at their squad and the names on the bench were... The fact that they can bring on the quality of player they have. Thiago Silva was on the bench. Reece James was on the bench. Kai Havertz was on the bench. It's just the phenomenal squad that they have that at their disposal, that no matter who they play, it doesn't weaken the side at all. It increases their potential of anything and probably makes them better. And you just think going through the season with the amount of games they have, Champions League, that if he can pick on this and keep them all happy, they'd be sensational.
Alan, I didn't know a whole lot about Chalobah before he played on Saturday, but it was some screamer he scored, and what a way to start his Chelsea career.
Yeah, great goal, Ruby, and I think Mason Mount put a picture of it up after the match, that obviously they played with each other through the U team as well, so that's another added bonus with Tuchel. Obviously they're able to spend the money and bring in the superstars, but there's something special about bringing a young lad through from the youth system as well, particularly with the fans and that connection. And you could see what it meant to the young fellow when he scored. He was almost taken aback with the emotion. He knew what it meant, and it was a great goal. So I think that adds to Tuchel's kind of the fact that he's done so well since he's gone into Chelsea. He's built up such huge credibility. They kept the momentum going, winning the Super Cup. Now they've obviously got off to a great start. But I always think there's something special about bringing a young lad through from the youth system, and especially with Mount and the relationship he has there. So it's all going swimmingly for Chelsea. And now with Lukaku coming in as well, Ruby, they'll be hard bet this year, Chelsea.
Now that we're heading into the World Cup qualifier time of the year as well, we will be definitely on Republic of Ireland player watch for the next few weeks. And usually we don't have too much positive things to report. It's usually injuries or somebody's going to be out for a foreseeable amount of time. But we do have something very positive, and that was Shane Duffy coming back this weekend, Stephen, and playing really well and been really happy with the situation that he's in. He was interviewed afterward by the club. He said he thought that Premier League was nearly gone from him, and now he's back and seems to be in a good place.
He's just delighted to be given opportunity. Ben White going has just given him a chance that he probably wouldn't have got if that hadn't happened. And for him, he's been given something that he felt, like I said, he felt it was gone. He went to Celtic and last year was a bit of a disaster for him all around. It was nice to see him in the summer in the international games where he actually performed and he was back to being a bit of a leadership role for us. But to have him back playing is going to be, for Stephen Kenny, it's going to make a huge difference to have a player of his stature and his, just what he brings to the side in his knowledge and his experience. But for him to get back playing Premier League football is huge. And for us as a nation, we need players playing at that level.
I think, to be fair to him, Marie, as well, he deserves a huge amount of credit because he made major changes to his lifestyle. He looks fitter, he looks stronger. And if you go back to it as well, he's a human being at the end of the day. He went through a lot of, he lost his dad. He was going through a really difficult time, I'd say personally, trying to deal with that. Then he gets a move to Celtic, his boyhood club. We all know where he's from and the history that's gone on there. He gets a move to Celtic, so he's probably even over trying to impress when he went to Celtic, and it turned into an absolute nightmare for him. It's brilliant to see him, and he deserves a huge amount of credit. I know one of the members of staff that's in with Stephen Kenny, and he speaks glowingly about Shane Duffy and what he brings to the group and how good he is and infectious around all the other players. So especially from our point of view, as you say, with the big games coming up, Marie, I think he deserves a huge amount of credit for getting back to some sort of form, and the fact that he's been given that opportunity, as Stephen says, playing every week in the Premier League with Brighton. I think it's good for us.
Let's hope he brings that form to Stephen Kenny's squad. Stephen Kelly and Alan Cawley, thanks a million. We're going to take another quick break.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Farm's new high protein cooked chicken breast fillets, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now I am still joined by Stephen Kelly and Alan Colley. Alan, it was also a busy weekend in the Premier League, or in the League of Ireland.
I was in Dalymount yesterday, Marie. Huge game when you think third v fourth, and obviously Bohemians have been getting a lot of plaudits with European football in recent weeks. But the problem for them is that they're sitting in fourth position, and it would be an absolute disaster if they don't get into one of those European positions by the season finishes. So they're chasing down Sligo Rovers. There were 7 points behind them going into the game yesterday, but they put in a brilliant performance, and even more so, Marie, the fact that they were away during the week in Greece travelling. They've been travelling around Europe over the last 3 or 4 weeks, and the energy levels that they showed and the desire to I suppose, I wouldn't say grind out the win, but just the fact that it would have been very tiring on them in that second half, and they were absolutely brilliant, and they got the 1-0 win with Keith Buckley as well, so fair play to them.
And just when you do look at the top of the table, Alan, it is getting very tight up there.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Obviously, Shamrock Rovers won against Drogheda as well. Big win for them. But Drogheda have been in free fall in recent weeks. But it was a big win for them, Shamrock Rovers. And St. Pat's getting a good win on Friday night as well against Waterford 2-1. Because Waterford have been in good form. I think they'd won 4 on the bounce going into that. So it just keeps it interesting for us at the top. I'd still fancy Shamrock Rovers. But I think what gives St. Pat's a huge chance as well, Marie, if Shamrock Rovers get through the playoff round and they get into the Conference League group stage, and they're having to juggle that, that'll give St. Pat's a huge advantage, because obviously they'll be able to concentrate in just the league games, whereas Shamrock Rovers will be trying to juggle the whole lot.
That's a brave prediction, fancying Shamrock Rovers, considering they're 3 points in front with a game in hand.
They weren't in front on Friday night though, Alan, in fairness.
No, they weren't, Ruby. Will you give me a chance?
I just thought it was incredibly brave. Like, that's like saying Longford will go down.
No, well, I tipped them at the start. I tipped Longford to go down to the start as well, so I'm writing that one. But everyone tipped Shamrock Rovers, and they should be winning the league. But St. Pat's have certainly made it interesting. But I think, obviously, as you say, the position that Shamrock Rovers are in, they should go on and win the league, Ruby, but I think the only chance that Pats will have, and they're just trying to hang on the coattails of them, but the only chance, but it'll be a huge chance. If Shamrock Rovers get through to that group stage, I can't tell you how difficult that's going to be, trying to juggle games from a Thursday to a Sunday. That'll give St. Pat's a huge advantage, but you're right, Shamrock Rovers should go on and win it.
Okay, well, we are going to take a very, very quick break now, and then we'll be back with Shane McGrath on Tipperary's former manager now, Liam Sheedy. 2FM.
Game on 2FM. With Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
So Tipperary are looking for a new hurling manager. Liam Sheedy announced that he is stepping down along with his backroom team. And a little bit earlier, he spoke to Damien Lawler.
You always say you review after each season, and we took it season by season. You know, we were fortunate enough to be in there. It was a privilege to be in there for 3 years. And, you know, when you sit back and reflect, you know, it's a big commitment, a massive commitment. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed my 3 years. And I just felt it's probably at a time where it's either another three or else it's game over. And for us, I think the best decision for us was to take a step back at this stage. Look, everyone has a quiet season, and, you know, straight away people are very quick to jump to conclusions. That's a really, really proud dressing room that I have been involved with. We're a really, really proud hurling county, and I would say the future is going to remain very, very bright. You should always keep your systems under review, but I'd be hugely excited about what the future holds for Tipperary hurling.
So Liam Sheedy speaking there a little bit earlier on his retirement. Shane McGrath now, former Tipperary captain, joins us on the line. Shane, from everybody that has spoken today, it seems that Liam Sheedy was a great man to play under.
Sure. Not only a great man to play under, Marie, but just a great man to know. Like, I mean, like anybody that's worked with him, or like, be it sporting or business-wise, you're just a better person after knowing him. Like, and I suppose, you know, it's a sad day for Tipperary people, because, you know, you mightn't see Liam Sheedy involved now again in Tipperary hurling. But I suppose Liam is the kind of person to say, if I'm not the right person to take him on, then I won't, like, so. And that's what he has decided, like.
It is, and he did what he came in to do. He won another All-Ireland with Tipperary. He had a 3-year tenure, and he's moved on. Is it the right time for him to move on, having been knocked out at the quarterfinals the last 2 years, all said and done?
I think it is. I think it is, Ruby, like, because, like, he's come in, like, you know, it's his second stint back, and, you know yourself, very few managers are successful their second time round. And kind of Sheedy kind of disproved that, I suppose, came back, won All-Ireland the first year. But I think Liam knows maybe that he's not the right man take Tip to the next step. Whatever the next step is now, the word transition has been used and all that. I wouldn't agree with that too much. I think there'll always be good players in Tip. like a lot of the hurling counties. But I just feel that Liam will always put Tip Hurling first, in regards that people feel that, oh, maybe that Liam is all about what he wants to get out of it, and like it couldn't be further from the truth. Like, because he'll feel personally, and he would have thought about it long and hard, that like if he wanted a job, I have no doubt Tip County Board would have said, yeah, you're the guy to lead us forward. But Liam would have said, do you know what, I'm not the right guy to lead this group forward for the next year's championship or the next 2 years. And you know, I'm sure it was a hard decision for him and for his family and everything, but at the end of the day, he'll do what's best for Tip Hurling, and this is what he feels is best for Tip Hurling, lads. And I suppose, look, Tip is a traditional county, so they will probably won't go outside the county, lads. They'll probably, the next Tip manager will, I'd say 99.9% be from Tipperary, like.
And who do you think it'll be then, Shane?
Sure, I'd say, Marie, like, Liam Tahill's name has been thrown around. He's done his 2 years in Waterford. The current backroom team would include Darry Egan, Tommy Dunn, you know, Owen Kelly, guys like this, with John Devan, which is 20, so... No, there's four or five guys that, you know, would you know, it would be a big step up, but would be well able to do the job. So I don't know, Marie. I don't know. It'll be an interesting few days for the county board, but I think I do feel that they will act fast, and they will have to act fast to get the guy they really want to do it.
Yeah, well, it'll
and
be an interesting.
Whoever that will be interesting, I suppose, isn't it?
And it'll be interesting for Waterford as well. Shane McGrath, thank you so much for joining us. That is all we have time for. Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly, thank you for coming into studio. Myself and Ruby will be back tomorrow. Graeme Smith is in next for Tara Stewart.
Live across the nation, this is RTE 2FM.